We talked with the writer Colin Dickey this week. Colin Dickey, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing okay, hanging in there. We've got a little tropical storm bearing down on us.
Yeah. We've had him on the show before. He writes about strange subjects that come with weird stories, and we're always up for that. A few years ago, he wrote about haunted places in the country, and he went around looking for ghosts. The thing that interested him was about how people who are very much alive deal with stories about the undead. Now, his latest book is about why people become obsessed with things that are unexplained. So lots of good stories here, too, like this one. A bright spring day in 1876. This is March. Bath County, Kentucky. The story involves a woman named Mrs. Allen Crouch. And as Dickey tells it, she's outside of her house. She's in the yard and she's making soap. Basically, she's alone. Her grandson is around. And the skies are completely clear. She was adamant about this. The skies were clear. And all of a sudden,
out of nowhere, it begins to rain meat out of the sky.
It falls in an area of about 100 yards long and about 50 yards wide. And she's really specific, Mrs. Crouch, about this. She says about a half a bushel fell.
And there's no clear indication of where this meat comes from. But it definitely happened.
And there's this great detail in the story. Her grandson sees this and he says, "Grandma, it's snowing." And when the stuff starts to fall, she panics. She grabs her grandson, runs inside, and she says, "It's a miracle from God that it was a sign." And the story takes off.
Later, a reporter from the New York Herald came to Olympia Springs to learn more about the story, because by now it's a national news story. And he tries to hire a guy he describes as an Irish laborer to taste this meat for him and see if he can identify it. So the laborer agrees, and the first thing he says is, "I can't have this without something to wash it down. You know, I'm going to need some whiskey." And so the reporter gets him some whiskey and says, "Okay, great, you got your whiskey." And stalling a little bit more for time, he says, "I normally don't eat meat without sides. Maybe some bread or some vegetables or something." And the reporter says, "Okay, I'll do that." Gets him his requisite sides. And now the laborer, having agreed to this thing and suddenly realizing the task before him, is running out of options. And he finally says to the reporter, "You know what? I just remembered it's Lent and I can't eat meat during Lent, and I'm out of here." Perhaps the best explanation there is that it was a pack of vultures who were all group vomiting. That seems to be the most commonly accepted explanation, except for the fact that there are no reports of any vultures in the sky. So what we have is a story that one way or another happened, and for which we have no real conclusive definitive explanation of exactly what happened.
What is it that interests you about this story? I mean, it's a great story, but what is the thing about it that really interests you?
This story happens in the 1870s, at a time when science and religion are separating themselves out into mutually exclusive camps, each of which promises a way to explain how the world works. And at the same time that this is happening, you do have these very strange moments that really don't seem to be things that either religion or science really wants to touch. And I think I've always been drawn to these stories that exist in the fringe, that don't yield easy explanations or pat solutions.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Colin Dickey is joining us today. His book is called The Unidentified. And he told us that as he was writing the book, he noticed the belief in ghosts, it's different from a belief in Bigfoot.
When I started with this book, which deals with UFOs and aliens and, you know, cryptids, the Loch Ness Monster, Bigfoot, I was somewhat surprised to find that as a collection, those beliefs are much more contemporary, that they don't stretch back beyond the 19th century. You know, so the lost continent of Atlantis, for example, is first posited by Plato in the Socratic dialogues, but it's mentioned there pretty clearly as sort of not a real place so much as a kind of philosophical figure of speech or something, you know, a way for him to work out his ideas about past and history and human civilization. And that's largely how it's treated for the next several millennia. And it's not until the 1870s that Ignatius Donnelly writes a book called Atlantis, which for the first time argues that it is a legitimate, real archaeological place that had a physical existence and has sunk below the waves. And so there's something that happens in the 19th century that triggers a new set of beliefs that is very specific, I think, to the rise of a kind of modern industrialized world. And that struck me as quite different than how we approach ghosts.
Explain the difference between Plato's thinking about a place like Atlantis and Donnelly's idea that Atlantis actually exists. Because this seems like a really important distinction. The idea that people of an ancient world didn't really care about the idea of this place actually existed. The idea of a utopia, for example, wasn't real. It wasn't supposed to be real. But somehow in the 19th century, people start wanting something to be real. And I guess this is a reaction to science, the way science is emerging. So talk about the difference between those.
For Plato's audience, it's probably fair to say they simply didn't care whether Atlantis was real or not. And I think for most pre-modern audiences, there was, broadly speaking, there was the known world, and then there was everything beyond the borders of the known world. And the known world was something that people understood and could move through, and they understood the animals and the physics and the weather that sort of dictated those realities. But there was always this assumption that just beyond the border was something sort of wild and untamed and uncivilized. And there, anything was possible, you know, giants with their heads and their torsos, or, you know, one-footed humans, or fish that suicided themselves on the beach every year on Easter to give humans something to eat. You know, I mean, these sort of, you know, the kind of wild traveler tales that Marco Polo or John Mandeville would bring back were sort of accepted as under a belief that once you got beyond the borders of the known world, anything was possible. And of course, they had no means of verifying that because, you know, most of these people were not going to travel those places themselves. And so there was no real reason to doubt that view of the world. What happens by the 19th century is that the world has been largely filled in. Globalization, you know, has sort of reached to the point where, you know, particularly for Westerners who sort of maintain this idea of, you know, the frontier was quote unquote settled. Africa had been more or less completely colonized, or at least, you know, mapped out by Europeans. North America had been colonized by Western settlers. And so the idea that there was civilization and then, you know, beyond the frontier sort of ceased to have a real meaning for people as the map got filled in. And so Donnelly comes along and posits Atlantis as a place that kind of rekindles that idea. You know, Atlantis will always be the undiscovered country because it's gone. And so we're never going to know what it was like there. There's never going to be a Starbucks or a McDonald's at Atlantis. It can always be that place that keeps alive that pre-modern understanding of a kind of place beyond the frontier where anything is possible.
So there are these two shocks, these two great shocks that you say happen in the 19th century that set the stage for these kinds of beliefs. And the first one is, as you say, there was this divorce of science and religion. Talk a little bit about that particular shock and how that starts to change the way people are believing in or thinking of, you know, fantastical beings and creatures.
One of the sort of famous phrases that gets used to describe this period by this German economist Max Weber is the disenchantment of the world.
Yeah.
That with the rise of the scientific method and increasingly good scientific tools, you know, microscopes, telescopes, etc., the world becomes quote unquote known in a way that it hadn't been before. And for Weber, this idea is that the world is disenchanted now. Everything that exists has a purpose or a function. It has a utilitarian value to us, or it doesn't. You know, minerals we now know to have purpose that can be used in technology, or, you know, sold on the market or whatever. Sort of everything now has a use value. And that's the idea of this kind of disenchanted world. And the animals now no longer are these mythical, fantastical beasts so much as beings that we can slot one way or another into a great taxonomic system, what gets known as the Linnaean classification system, this idea that any animal we discover, we can give it a kingdom, an order, a phylus, a genus, a species, et cetera, and then we'll know, broadly speaking, you know, how it works, where it comes from, you know, what it's similar to, what it's dissimilar to. And the genius and the beauty of that system is it will accommodate everything. So every new animal that we discover, we either put it in an existing category, or if we have to, we invent a new category. But the system just expands to hold the entire living corpus of beings on the planet. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, the idea of a cryptid doesn't really exist before this taxonomic system, the idea of Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster. I mean, they exist in sort of legends, but they don't take on the form that they do in the 20th century. And that's because the form they take on in the 20th century is somehow outside of this classification system. In order for a cryptid to be considered, you know, valid as a cryptid, it has to be somehow beyond the world of normal animals. And so you get a difference between things like, you know, the giant squid or the giant panda, which were sort of thought to be mythical creatures until they were definitively discovered and then sort of made into part of that natural system, versus the chupacabra or the Jersey devil, you know, something that will always be sort of outside the bounds of scientific classification.
You mentioned in the book how there are people who believe that this scientific disenchantment has cost us something. You know, there are these people who want to believe in Atlantis or Bigfoot. So I get the idea that they're like, oh, we want there to be a world of wonder and marvel out there. But it's not that part that seems to worry you. It's the part of the story where this fascination with the mysterious evolves into something else. It seems like that's part of what maybe concerns you, like this distrust of science and institutions, this distrust of the establishment, basically. Talk about that.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, I don't think there's anything particularly harmful or dangerous about, you know, wanting to believe that the Loch Ness Monster is real or that Bigfoot exists. I've gone on cryptid hunts, gone out into the forest, trying to be as still as possible, hoping that I'll see something. And it's a kind of a fun experience. You know, it sort of teaches you to be out in nature in a way you might not otherwise be. So, yeah, I think that kind of yearning for the mysterious and things that are beyond belief, I think that is both very normal and human and also quite healthy. But there is a kind of fine line. You know, one of the more prominent Nessie believers is this guy, Henry Bauer, who used to be a dean at, I think, University of Virginia. And
for those who don't know what Nessie is, that's a shorthand for the Loch Ness Monster, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, the Loch Ness Monster, a.k.a. Nessie. So, and he maintained for a long time, you know, that there's nothing wrong with believing in Nessie or wanting to believe that Nessie exists. But over his career, Bauer slipped increasingly more and more into kind of conspiratorial anti-science beliefs, and most notably became an AIDS denialist. He disputed the science that HIV causes AIDS, and he used his position as a credentialed scientist to actually do a fair amount of damage by muddying the waters around HIV transmission and prevention. So that's an extreme case, but I think it does illustrate the danger that happens when you shift from wanting to believe in the mystical and the mysterious and then using that belief to then start to doubt mainstream science or call into question things that have been established.
So anti-vaxxers, school shooting truthers, even the Q theories, that sort of thing, that's a kind of a more modern version of a belief in Loch Ness Monster. It's a kind of a spin. It's how it's morphed into the modern world.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed in doing this research, which I thought was really kind of significant for me anyways, was that, you know, you either believe that the Loch Ness Monster exists or you don't. Fine. But you don't really believe that the existence of the Loch Ness Monster is being covered up by the government. Whereas with UFOs, it's quite the opposite. If you believe in UFOs, you pretty much by default also believe that the government is covering it up. you know, that they know something, or they have wrecked spaceships or bodies on ice somewhere, and they're hiding it from the American people. And what I found in sort of researching the history of that is in the 40s and 50s, everybody pretty much believed it was only a matter of time before the existence of UFOs was proven. But the definitive proof doesn't come, you know, other than the blurry photos and the eyewitness sightings, we don't get that definitive, unequivocal proof. And so gradually, a lot of the public sort of gives up and say, okay, I guess we were wrong. I guess these things don't exist. And another segment of the public starts looking for an explanation as to why, if this is true and these things are real, why haven't we seen them yet? And by the 60s and 70s and definitely the 80s, that answer is government conspiracy. So what starts as a belief in the kind of wondrous and magical and mystical, you know, the idea that there are other races out there and they're coming to communicate with us and they maybe bring us advanced technology or the keys to peace and happiness, that belief gradually becomes more and more sinister and more paranoid by no other function than the fact that the kind of expected revelation doesn't come on time. And so where we're at right now is we're at a moment where there is widespread disbelief in governmental figures of authority and also scientific figures of authority. And that doesn't come from nowhere. There's been a long, slow slide that I try to chart a little bit in the book that tries to understand a little bit of how we became a culture that is so ready to distrust authority figures to the point where what's happening now is it's literally killing us. This coronavirus pandemic is excelling in this country in a way that it's not in other countries because of just an extreme distrust of established authority figures.
I think it's really interesting the way you break down the basic elements of these stories. And they all seem to have certain characteristics. If you look at the Loch Ness Monster, you look at Bigfoot, you look at Lemuria, which we'll get to here in a moment, which because I think that's a great story. But they all have this thing that defies logic. There's always a credible witness. And one of the other parts of it is there's always a writer who takes the story and popularizes it. Like, that seems like that is a characteristic in almost all of these stories. So I want, and part of the book is talking about these characters, these people who really take these stories, curate them, collect them, do a decent bit of writing, and they take off. So let's talk about one of them, Erich von Däniken. Give us a sense of who he is, because this is a man who has these ideas about aliens. And the idea is that aliens were an ancient part of human history, that they either came from another galaxy or there was something else that was really exotic about them. Just talk a little bit about this idea and von Däniken.
Von Däniken is interesting because he's the one who popularizes the idea that the pyramids and Stonehenge and the Nazca lines were not built by humans, but were built by aliens who visited human culture eons ago. And what's curious, again, is he gets this idea not from thin air, not from some crank or some pseudoscience authority, but from none other than Carl Sagan, who in 1963... This is a legitimate topic of conversation among astronomers and astrophysicists. Are we alone in the galaxy? And the odds seem to be that given the number of planets, there's probably another one that is conducive to life. And if we could flourish in this planet, probably there are others with other kinds of life. And it seems within the realm of mathematical possibility that these other civilizations might have come our way. And if so, you know, where are they? And Carl Sagan, just as an aside, in one of his scientific articles says, well, you know, maybe they came in the past and we missed them already. Sagan doesn't really pursue this because it's nothing other than a supposition. It can't be proven. And so it doesn't make for good scientific inquiry because it's sort of hard to prove something that can't be falsified in that way. So he gives up on it. But von Däniken, who is a sort of hotel clerk and not trained as a scientist, he seizes on this idea and spins out this book called Chariot of the Gods, which argues that these earlier civilizations were somehow influenced by alien technology. And it
goes crazy, that book.
Oh, it goes crazy. And what's really fascinating is that it is a really indelible hypothesis. You know, archaeologists, mainstream archaeologists are endlessly frustrated with this idea because when people say, well, we don't know how the pyramids were built, they respond, well, in fact, we literally know how they were built. We, right. We have basically like IKEA instructions written in hieroglyphics right, for anybody right. who wants to like. So they're sort of frustrated that people won't take them seriously. But, you know, what I found, it was really fascinating. I forget which university it was, but in the 70s, they decided to study this, and they polled incoming archaeology students, their beliefs about von Daniken's ancient astronaut theory. And then they polled graduating seniors who now had legitimate degrees in archaeology, the same questions. And they found that it didn't change that much, that even going through a traditional university experience and being taught professional archaeology wasn't necessarily enough to dislodge this sort of fanciful hypothesis that, you know, aliens were somehow involved in making the pyramids.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's explain why, because this is, I think, an important concept in the book. The way these fringe beliefs are structured, the way they happen, and this is true of the way von Daniken is thinking about the, you know, these ancient, you know, alien astronauts, is they start with these legitimate gaps in knowledge, you say in the book. But then you take it further. So there are these gaps in knowledge. Well, we can't figure this out, even though in many cases we do know this. But there's this element here where science is just too arrogant. Scientists are too smug to entertain all of the possibilities. And there's this doubt about science not being open-minded enough. This seems like a really important element in this. Talk about that part.
As we were talking about before, a lot of these beliefs can be traced back to they get their start at the end of the 19th century. And what's happening in science at the end of the 19th century is that it's becoming more and more institutionalized. So you have, for the first time, you have PhD granting universities, you have professional organizations, you have science that is accelerating to a point where new discoveries aren't going to happen with just a kind of splendid amateur in his study with a microscope and some spare time. You know, now you need a lot more research, a lot more funding, you need a lot more work to kind of push science along. And so it ceases to be a discipline for untrained amateurs. And so I think one of the things that happens is as that shift is happening, you do get this pushback. So people like von Daniken, who again is not a trained scientist, Ignatius Donnelly, who was not a trained archaeologist, they respond by seeing science as sort of overly arrogant, as sort of not open to the common person. And they see that as a great failing of science. So they find that it's quite easy to turn people against mainstream science by talking about it as this kind of exclusive club that these kind of hidebound PhDs are so wedded to their power and their credentials that they're not actually aware of the truth. And, you know, and it, so it becomes this kind of, it becomes really easy to push an anti-authoritarian line, which again, you see carried through to today's anti-vaxxers and other science conspiracists who basically argue that somebody with Google and a hypothesis can learn more about the science of vaccines than someone who has a PhD and has been working in the field for decades.
Colin Dickey, his book is The Unidentified. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Station Insider is KUER's weekly email digest. We'll bring you the most important news stories of the week, information about online events and services during the coronavirus situation, and of course, sneak peeks of what's happening at the station. Check out our other regular dispatches too, including the Radio West newsletter. To sign up for these weekly updates, just go to KUER.org/newsletters.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer Colin Dickey is with us. His new book is called The Unidentified, and in it, he writes about a man named Charles Fort. Dickey describes him as a rogue historian and journalist who had the strong distrust of authority. Fort collected stories like the Great Meat Shower of 1876. Now, it wasn't that he believed these stories necessarily. He just wanted to challenge the experts and the scientists who were so sure they had explained them away.
He writes this book, his first book, The Book of the Damned. In The Book of the Damned, Fort decides rather than put forward a positive hypothesis of his own, he's simply going to advocate a kind of radical doubt and skepticism about the scientific establishment. And so the idea that these stories that he's collected of bizarre phenomenon or unexplained happenings are damned, they're damned facts, they don't belong in the scientific corpus because they don't fit the prevailing theories. And so he sort of uses them to critique a kind of institutionalization of science. But what he doesn't do is then promote his own wacky, weird hypothesis. And throughout the Book of the Damned, he basically keeps coming back to the same beat over and over again, which is, I don't have an explanation for this, but we have to take these things seriously. And I think that that openness to the weird and the unexplained without that same desire to put forward a hypothesis that then is not going to stand up under any scrutiny is what really separates Fort from somebody like Donnelly or somebody like Von Daniken or one of these people who were known in the, at the time as cranks, as I kind of describe in the book. You know, the crank is someone who has a theory. Fort kind of sidesteps that by and large not advocating theories. And that's why I think his books continue to resonate and are so fascinating.
Is there a part of you in some ways that kind of relates to Fort or might think he had it, if not entirely right, at least this idea of wanting to at least concede, we can't figure all this out. We don't have enough evidence to be able to say anything conclusive about that. And there it is.
Yeah, definitely. And I take a lot from Fort. And I think that as a sort of way of approaching a lot of this stuff, I think he is really a fascinating figure. I disagree with him on his sort of knee-jerk anti-science bent at times. And one of the things I think that Fort gets wrong, and what a lot of conspiracy theorists get wrong, is the idea that science is a movable object, that it's not sort of constantly revising itself. You know, so for example, when Fort was writing, the planet Pluto had not yet been discovered and it had not yet been demoted to a non-planet. And so a lot of his sort of astronomical ideas and his willingness to look at astronomy and say, well, you know, you guys have got this clearly all wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, misses the point that scientists themselves are more than willing to say, well, we don't know all the answers and we're still working on it. And what makes sense today may not actually hold water and we'll have to abandon that theory in 10 or 20 years. And that's what I think is great about the scientific method, is that it's open to constant revision. And so I think that Fort is definitely right in his willingness to call up these things which don't seem to fit and which seem unexplainable or too bizarre to even really be like talked about in polite society. And I like him, I want to bring those things up. I want to explore them. I want to geek out on what they possibly could be and what that says about the world. And also like him, I want to avoid putting my own hypothesis that is sort of weird and outlandish is the only way to make sense of these things. I like the fact that these things are unexplained, but I also like the fact that we could very well get explanations for them and within my lifetime. And wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah. Let's talk about Mount Shasta, this mysterious mountain. And there are those who, you know, believe that there are these mysterious creatures living inside. And I want to talk about this story just as a way of you talking about the experience of reporting this and the conversations you have with people who believe in these mysterious creatures. They're called Lemurians, and maybe we should spend a little bit of time explaining this idea, the Lemurians. Talk a little bit about that first.
So like Atlantis, this lost continent that is somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, there have long been arguments that there is a similar lost continent in the Pacific that's called Lemuria. Again, this starts from a genuine scientific hypothesis. A geologist in the 1860s, I believe, is trying to explain why there are lemurs in Madagascar and in India, but not in mainland Africa. And he proposes as a possibility, you know, what if there was like a land bridge or a continent that stretched between Madagascar and India, and at some point it broke off and sunk into the ocean. And he proposes it, you know, we could call it Lemuria. And so this idea gets bandied about in scientific circles for a while before geologists abandon it. And then they sort of hit upon the idea of plate tectonics and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's sort of, again, it's a scientific hypothesis. It's tested out. It doesn't quite work. It gets abandoned. That's great. That's what science should be doing. But meanwhile, this idea of the lost continent of Lemuria becomes resurrected by the mystics and the cranks as this kind of magical, unreachable civilization that, like Atlantis, existed and was filled with these sort of fantastic beings that were maybe more advanced than humans, maybe less advanced than humans, depending on who you talk to. And then by the early 20th century, this guy, Harvey Savay, suggesting that, in fact, California itself might be the remnant of Lemuria, that the Great Salt Lake was, in fact, the ocean that separated North America from Lemuria before it kind of crashed into North America and formed the Sierra Nevadas, and that in fact, California is itself Lemuria. And he singles out Mount Shasta in particular as this place. And so Mount Shasta becomes this home for believers in the lost continent of Lemuria. And they hypothesize that beneath the mountain is the lost city of Telos, where the Lemurians live. And so I was doing research, and I was reading these accounts from the 20s and 30s of park rangers basically complaining about all these kind of weird kooks who were kind of flooding the mountain with crystals and other bizarre paraphernalia and, you know, what a real drag was. And I hadn't really thought that that might still be going on. But, you know, I went out to Mount Shasta, and sure enough, I found that the town itself is still very much in the grip of this idea of Lemuria. And so I went there for a couple of days, and I was just going to bars and restaurants, and I would just strike up a conversation with anybody who would talk to me, and I'd ask them if they had seen things. And this one bar patron, he said, half the people in this town believe that stuff, and the other half, well, they want to kill the first half, you know, like, you know, so there is this kind of tension between this small mountain town and this kind of mystic community. And so, but it was fascinating that some of these stories were pretty, I guess, to my mind, unremarkable. You know, one guy I talked to who said he was snowboarding on the mountain one time, and he stopped, and then he saw something in the sky, and then all of a sudden it was 2 hours later. And that's all. That's, you know, I mean, again, it's sort of a fascinating story, but I don't know what to make of it. But other people had.
Well, wait, tell about the part where one of the Lemurians apparently shows up at a farmer's market or something, or you see him around town or something.
Right. Yeah. So this bartender tells me the story about he's driving home one night, and so it wasn't a farmer's market, but he's driving home one night, and he sees this guy hitchhike, and he stops to give this guy a ride, and this guy gets in his car, and he has around his neck a cage with a live raven in the cage around his neck. And he's basically like, can you just take me up the mountain? And it's like the middle of the night, you know, it's not the middle of the night, but it's late. And you don't exactly go hiking on Mount Shasta at 10 PM at night, but the guy obliges, and he takes him a ways up the winding road that takes you up to Mount Shasta. And then at some point this hitchhiker just says, okay, this is fine. And he gets off, and he walks off into the darkness of the mountain. And, you know, and the bartender's like, I don't know. Who was that guy? I don't know, you know, but, you know, so it's like, so you have these kind of weird stories that then feed a little mythology. And so a lot of people I talked to, they were sort of just not willing to completely dismiss it out of hand. Even as they were telling it, you could tell they were a little bit sheepish or chagrined. They sort of understood a little bit what they were saying to me, but they were, you know, willing to go there.
Yeah. One thing I liked about this story, the kind of angle on this story that I thought was interesting, is you mentioned, you know, so Weber is talking about, we're losing the sense of enchantment. We're becoming disenchanted as a culture, as a society. But he also talks about, or you mention in the book, that the interesting part of this story is it wasn't just religion that is being stripped out of these things. It's the physical world itself, you write, seems to have lost its luster, its mystery and magic. So maybe that's part of the appeal for a place like Lemuria or Atlantis, for that matter, actual places that are mysterious when there really aren't any anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, and this was the other thing that surprised me. I mean, I grew up in the Bay Area in California, and I went to college in Oregon, which meant that I drove up and down Interstate 5 past Mount Shasta a lot, you know, and I'm very used to seeing that mountain. And it is, if you've seen it, it's a very striking mountain. The High Cascades, Mount Hood and Mount Rainier and St. Helens as well are these mountains that rise up out of nowhere. They're not part of a elongated mountain range like the Sierra Nevada. And so each one kind of stands alone on the horizon. And so Shasta sort of, it has this kind of magical feel about it. And it's also quite known for these lenticular clouds, which are these kind of halo clouds that will form around the peak that just sort of look like these disembodied smoky rings. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I was quite blown away with just the feeling that mountain gives you when you're close to it, you know, because it is such a singular striking presence that fills up your periphery no matter where you are in town. And it's hard not to feel that it's exuding some mystery. You know, I wouldn't go so far as to say I believe there's a lost civilization underneath it, but I also really felt something in the presence of it that I thought, well, you know, this is itself not nothing. And you're right. I mean, I think that skeptic would respond to a feeling like that and just sort of dismiss it out of hand and say, well, you know, that's just kooky woo nonsense. And I kind of want to push back against that. And I want to kind of find a middle ground between believing a wild conspiracy and then also on the one hand or on the other hand, sort of dismissing that feeling of kind of awe and transcendence altogether.
I want to talk a little bit about how cryptozoology is born. You write about this, but we need to get back to the Loch Ness Monster. So take us through this story, if you would, because I think it's interesting the way it evolves and the way it seems to spark, at least contribute to the emergence of this idea called cryptozoology. So 1930, I think, is where you take up the story. Three young men are fishing in the waters of Loch Ness, and they see something. Take it from there, if you would.
I think it's dusk, and they see something that they can't quite explain. And, you know, it looks like some sort of large creature of some kind. And, you know, and again, that's how a lot of these things start. They start with a pretty credible eyewitness.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people are like, oh, maybe something's out there. And within a short time, it gets picked up by the local news and then gets syndicated to the London press. And it's that's when it starts to take off, because now you have this large metropolitan audience who is reading about something which is far away, but not so far away that you can't go there. You know, it's sort of northern Scotland is sort of just far enough away that you could imagine something strange going there, but also where you could go and check it out if you wanted to. And so there's this kind of flurry in the early 30s that everybody's looking for evidence of this thing. And there's this one sort of famous big game hunter who shows up and he says, oh, I found a footprint, you know, of this thing walking across the road. And everybody gets really excited for a hot second before it's discovered that it's actually, I believe, a rhino footprint that he had like a stuffed rhino foot from his travels in Africa. And he sort of pushed it into the mud and tried to pass it off as Nessie footprints. And so you get these hoaxes, you get this kind of hysteria that flares up and then it dies down. And again, you know, like we were talking about with the UFOs, it's like you know, most of the world kind of goes back to its day-to-day reality, but the ones who continue to believe in it quickly find themselves further and further on the outs of mainstream science.
Well, the story sort of comes and goes. It true to the form, as you say, you need a credible witness. They had it. You have something that defied logic. That has it. And you need a writer to sort of to really blow up the story. You have that in the story of Loch Ness. This writer named Constance White writes this book that becomes really popular. But then you talk about how there's this right around the late 1980s, the story starts to fall apart. People come forward, admit it was a gimmick, it was a hoax. What does that do to the story when it's revealed that when there is actual evidence, actual people coming forward to say, yeah, this is not true? How does that change things?
You know, it turns out that it really doesn't change things at all. A good parallel is the history of spiritualism, the idea of, you know, that spirits will communicate via table rappings and seances and stuff like that, which gets started by Kate and Margaret Fox in upstate New York in 1840.
Which you wrote about in Ghostland, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. So this is from my previous book, but I think it gets to the same point, is that late in her life, Kate Fox announces that the whole thing was a put on. And she explains on stage at the music hall in New York City how she and her sister were basically able to create these rappings that sounded like a ghost was knocking on the floorboard. And they did it by like cracking the knuckles in their toes in this sort of peculiar way or something. And so within a couple of months, basically, she is forced to recant her confession because there's such outrage and people absolutely refuse to believe her that she basically has to pull it back and say, no, in fact, spirits are real. So, you know, with the Loch Ness Monster, right, we have a confession by basically an advertising executive who confesses that they were tasked with drumming up tourism to that area. And they took some folk story about this, you know, water creature, and they decided to make it into a thing to draw people up into the region, you know. And you have the son of the guy who faked the famous what's known as the surgeon's photograph, which is probably the photograph most of us know best of the Loch Ness Monster, the kind of grainy black and white photo of the neck coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. The guy who faked that, his son basically comes forward and says, yeah, it was absolutely a staged hoax. Here's how he did it. So like right there, you have these people coming forward and saying it was all based on a hoax, and it literally does not matter to most people. By that point, the belief is doing something more and something very fundamental to people. And once that belief sets in, I think the facts are next to irrelevant for a lot of people.
You put it this way in the book, and I found this really interesting. You say that these beliefs for a lot of people satisfies something deep and pleasing, that this idea of pleasure, this pleasure that they're getting from this belief, is more important than their truth or their falsity. So I kind of liked this idea that there's something pleasurable about these beliefs.
And you can certainly see that in a tagline of the X-Files that show, I want to believe. Right. It's not I believe or I'm afraid that aliens exist, or I want this to happen. I the idea of believing in aliens is pleasurable. It's a nice feeling. One of the ways that really led me to this book was probably 5 or 6 years ago. I was exactly the guy, like so many of us, who on social media, on Facebook or whatever, a coworker or a cousin or somebody would post some kind of conspiracy theory, and I would be the person in the comments righteously explaining the facts and the truth and, giving them the science, and watching as they just completely steamrolled over that and it turned into a big flame war, and I, ended up unfriending them or whatever. And, and what I learned is that for most people, facts are really not what they're interested in, that these conspiracy theories are doing something on a core psychological level. If you aren't aware of that, and if you don't attend to that, then it really doesn't matter. The facts are necessary because it does help to be able to explain what the true facts are, but they're not sufficient. And what is more important than the facts is to get at whatever psychological need or belief or pleasure or desire that the conspiracy theory is working on this person.
So 1876, there's this strange meat that comes raining from the sky. And at the time, they were put in jars to preserve them. Some of it was anyway. And you encountered one of these jars of meat. I wanted to have you talk about this experience too.
This was late in the research process. I hadn't really expected to come across this, but I found that there is a jar of supposedly the last remaining piece of meat from the Great Kentucky Meat Shower. It was found by this art historian at Transylvania University in Kentucky while he was going through kind of an old storage closet. It's an old university, and he found this jar sealed with some kind of formaldehyde-ish alcohol solution, and it said in faded script on the jar, it said Olympia Springs, and floating inside this solution was this chunk of something. It's a very striking piece of organic matter, for lack of a better term.
Called it eerily beautiful.
I mean, it is eerily beautiful. Yeah. It is intensely disgusting. Yeah. It is this kind of white, bloated, it's about maybe like an inch in size. It's really hard to know what to make of it, but it's also really hard to, take your eye off it. So I went to Transylvania University, where it is housed in the Monroe Musnick Museum. And I was able to talk to Kurt about, what this meat is, a couple of years ago, he tried to have its DNA sequenced, hoping that maybe we could find out a little bit more, but it turns out that the sample is just way too degraded. The DNA is just broken down. So they couldn't get a definitive DNA sequence out of it. And so it is this weird object from another time that exists kind of out of place and yet won't go away. Yes. It's still there.
Yeah. Well, and you say that when this happened in 1876, this was a different time, in the sense that people, you say, then were more or less okay with some things just being pure wonder, which makes me wonder now, do you think we'll ever see another meat shower? Or another phenomenon at least play out in the way that one did.
Right. Yeah. And this is something that Kurt also mentioned. You know, he said, you know, if this were to happen today, we would know what it was, because our documentation, our scientific understanding, our ability to kind of process events like this has just reached a point where, you know, I think he's right. I think we would just know what it was, you know, and we would have an explanation. We'd all kind of understand that to be the case. And so yeah, some of these things, they linger because they came about at a specific point in time in history, and they got kind of frozen in the record in this kind of unusual way that gives them this kind of bizarre and odd staying power. When I was kind of researching, you know, Bigfoot, for example, I mean, Bigfoot's legend solidifies at a very specific time in the history of photographic technology, because a lot of the legend is dependent on somebody basically saying, well, I was walking through a clearing and I saw this thing and I scrambled for my camera, but I was only able to get this one grainy, blurry shot, and I don't know what it is, but it sort of looks like a creature. And people would say, yeah, okay, yeah, I believe that. You know, whereas now, you know, everybody's got a high definition camera in their pocket. Everybody's got an iPhone, you know. So if Bigfoot were to be born today, it would have to be born in the story would have to be born in a different kind of way, because it couldn't rely on the out of focus black and white photo in the way that Bigfoot itself really depended on to sort of get into public consciousness. And so I think that's a facet of a lot of these things, that they are of their time and place in a way that I think is really fascinating.
You know, it's a tough balance, I think, to strike if you're an enlightened human being who wants to believe in facts, and the fact that wearing a mask during a pandemic is sensible and you know, all of those kinds of things. But there's also that part where you think it's cool that there's a story out there that's hard to figure out or explain. It's kind of doesn't mean there's a supernatural force there, but it's a cool kind of mystery. And that seems to be where you sort of came down, because you talk about how there is a way, as you put it in the book, to cling to wonder, but not let doubt turn into its own kind of certainty. That's how you put it. Would you say something about that?
One of the organizations I visited was the Lemurian Foundation, which is a kind of bizarre little group in San Diego who, you know, as the name implies, sort of clings to the idea of Lemuria. And on their website, they have this quote from Francis Bacon that I ended up using as one of the epigraphs in the book, which is, if you begin with certainties, you will end in doubt. But if you begin in doubt, you will end in certainties. And I saw that a couple places too. That wasn't the only place I saw that Francis Bacon quote. And how it seems to get used by these groups is, again, as a critique of mainstream science, you know, that if you start with the certainty of mainstream science, in fact, you will end up finding holes and problems in the theory and you'll end up doubting everything. But if you begin with an open mind, they seem to be suggesting, you will arrive at actual truth. What I saw instead is that if you let doubt become its own orthodoxy, you will end up with a kind of certainty which is itself as problematic as the thing that you think that you're critiquing. And that, again, I think is the difference between somebody like Fort, who was more than happy to critique mainstream science, but hesitant to put forward his own certainties to compete with mainstream science. So I do want, in both the book and just in my life, to kind of keep open that space for the unexplained or the mysterious or the unreachable or a world just kind of outside of our understanding that sort of exists on the perpetual periphery. But I don't feel the same need that some people do to definitively assert what that world is or how it works.
Colin Dickey, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Colin Dickey, his book is The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.